Good evening. Can you hear okay? Okay. Well, I'd like to start by clearing up something that was said in the announcements. I think there was a misstatement in the announcements. What I heard, anyway, was that our teacher, who's coming August 4th, is one of only two people to receive Dharma transmission. And I think there were some words left out. First, that was the words that were left out. Yeah. And so I don't, you know, that's an important correction, but it's also quite relevant to what I wanted to talk about tonight. because our tradition, our Zen tradition, been carried forward by the meeting between a teacher and student from the time of the Buddha until the present day. And so it's that encounter, that face-to-face encounter, has been a vital part of the Zen practice tradition since the inception, as important as the practice, or actually vital to the teaching of enlightenment, of enlightened life, is this encounter between teacher and student that, you know, in the latter days, or as time went on, became formalized in, you know, ritual and so forth. So now there can be the appearance of people, you know, for instance, in our tradition, in brown ocases or brown rakasus, significant of having received that face-to-face transmission from their teacher. So the Zen tradition has really, and in story, has really been carried forward by the stories of these meetings that have gone on for myriad centuries between teacher and students, and there again, some of these stories have been captured and collected for our review in the present day, and for generations to come. So there's a particular story, or maybe a couple of stories, that I wanted to bring up tonight. This stories of this interaction between teacher and student. And the first story I'll bring up is a story about the Zen master Dungshan. And Dungshan's quite a famous teacher in our lineage, considered to be one of the two founders of the Soto Zen school. He was a Chinese person. He lived in the 9th century. And his name, Dungshan, is captured in the Chinese version of Soto. We know it as Soto Zen, but in Chinese it's Sao Dong, and the Dong is from his name, Dungshan. So there's this story of Dungshan meeting his teacher, and at this time, this was a time that they were meeting, and Dungshan was taking his leave. He was going off to another place to practice. And so he asked his teacher, In the future, when somebody asks me about you, what should I say? What would you have me say? And his teacher Yun Yen said, or apparently he, according to the story, he reflected on the question for a bit, and then he said, just this person. Just this person. That's what I'd have you say about me. And in the translator's notes in the record of Dungshan, it says that the phrase, just this person, was actually used in the court system in China. And it was how a person who was pleading guilty would respond to the magistrate. So the magistrate would say, basically, you've been charged with such and such, and the prisoner would say, just this person. This was a way of admitting guilt. So I think when we practice with the earphone, and make sure that it stays on our ear, when we practice, I don't know what I was supposed to do, I missed a step. This helps. And when we practice, we become, keenly aware. I think one of the primary teachings of our introspective meditation practice is to become aware of this person, just this person who's practicing, and just this person who's attempting to sit down and sit still and be quiet. And many of us have noticed that when we attempt to sit down and sit still and be quiet, many things rush to fill the void. Many thoughts, many feelings, many plans that we have for the future, maybe some regrets we have about the past, maybe some worries that we have, maybe some fear, maybe some joy, maybe some happiness. But something comes in. Tonight when I was sitting, I was thinking all that comes in is actually a kind of barrier. It's actually a kind of, it's kind of a barrier. And you have this feeling that there's something that has to be crossed to actually manifest this teaching that it's possible to sit down, to sit still, and be quiet, to not let active consciousness rule our experience. Bodhidharma said, no coughing or sighing, even in the mind. Now, Linda, she has some actual respiratory condition that maybe it's stimulated by this air conditioning. So, you know, some things can't be helped. So she felt like the best thing to do was to leave so we could have this quiet. We could have this quiet space. But when we're sitting, the intent is no, you know, we can't always manifest this, right? But the intention is no coughing or sighing or audible breathing, even, in the space that we sit together in, to create this environment, to create the possibility of passing this barrier, passing the barrier of thought, passing the barrier of feelings. So far, most of this isn't what I was going to say. But that's how it goes sometimes. So I'll try to go back to what I was going to say a little bit. So it's pretty common to think that just this person, this kind of raw material of a person, let's say that there's a person, and we'll call it this person kind of raw material. There's a tendency to think that this raw material is pretty raw, not suitable for the enterprise which has been described, this enterprise of being still and quiet, because we notice how easily we become distracted. We notice how frequently our mind wanders. We notice how hard it is to focus on if we have a practice of attuning to the breath, of letting our consciousness ride the breath in and out. We notice how difficult it is to keep our attention on that simple practice. And then we notice things about our thinking. We notice very often that we have a lot of thinking. And if we examine this thinking, oftentimes we notice that this thinking is quite self-centered. I was recalling an experience today. This was back in the day when you could walk home from school by yourself. Most kids can't do this, I don't think, anymore. But we used to be able to walk home from school by ourselves. And one day I was walking home, and I noticed all I do walking along here is think. My mind is just filled with thoughts. And I was probably only like 8 or... I was in elementary school, so I don't know. I was like 8 years old or something like that, or 10 or something, I don't know. But I really noticed that how full of thoughts, how I was just like this thinking thing that was going along the street, you know. And that was really all that was happening. That was all that I was really involved in. And I guess I kind of thought that was odd for a second. I thought it was odd to be just walking down the street, just thinking all the time. So anyway, in meditation practice, you know, this, we notice that we have a hard time passing this barrier of thought. And, you know, Shohaku Okamura has this image. He says, you know, open the hand of thought. I think this came actually from his teacher, Uchiyama Roshi, who said, open the hand of thought. So like thought, the image is thought's kind of got a grip on us. You know, thought, our thinking has a kind of grip on us. And let our practice be to open release from, you know, this constant thinking process. So I think it's an important point of practice that we Yunyan answered Dungshan the way he did, just this person, it was kind of like a confession. You know, it was kind of like just this person. And I think this is an important point of practice. We have to confess how we are. And we have to be able to see ourselves as we are. We have to acknowledge these barriers that we have, these blockades that we have, and be honest, you know, that we're facing these things. We are who we are. We carry the karma that we do. And we're not using practice to go around that. We are who we are. We carry the karma that we do. And we don't use practice to go around who we are. We just acknowledge how it is for us right now. Sometimes it's very... We would really like to pass through the barrier of thought. We really would. But maybe this period, next period, it's not going to happen. So we just, you know, it's sometimes that's painful. It's kind of painful to for a person who, you know, aspires to be quiet and still, it's kind of painful to not be able to open the hand of thought, to just be in the grip. But, you know, Pema Chodron, she has a book called The Wisdom of No Escape. The wisdom of not escaping from who we are and what our situation is. And if we stay, and the idea of the wisdom part of no escape is that if we're able to stay with what's happening, even if it's unpleasant, even if it doesn't feel like the real thing, it doesn't feel like I'm getting anywhere, if we're willing to stay with that, stay with it, confess that, that's how it is, that's how it is, relax with that, it's okay. It's okay. That's just how it is right now. I'm breathing with that. That's the wisdom part. Just letting that be. Letting that be who we are right now. Just this person. I recently read in a book that the Japanese have a phrase, I guess it's a colloquial phrase that gets tossed around. I don't know, but it's a phrase that goes like this. I can't say it in Japanese. I can only say it in English. But the phrase is, in order to become myself, my mistakes and hardships were also necessary. In order to become myself, my mistakes and hardships were also necessary. That's the process of becoming just this person, acknowledging that our mistakes and our hardships are going to be necessary. So sitting practice, Zen practice, requires maybe above all else, maybe the most important virtue for Zen practice is patience. It's just to be patient with things as they are. It's really the kind of only alternative. Just to be patient with ourselves as we find ourselves. We have the idea that our situation is not ideal. And just to be patient with that. Just to be patient with our ideas that we're not in the ideal situation, and that we, you know, that our consciousness is not the ideal consciousness, and that our understanding is not the ideal understanding, and just to be patient with that, to be patient with ourselves as we are. When I first met my girlfriend, who would become my wife, I was at that same time I was starting a gardening business, and at some point early on in our relationship, I got a card from my girlfriend who was to be. No, I didn't know it at the time that she was going to become my wife, but that's the way it turned out. But I got a card, and it was a handmade card, and it was a picture of a weed for a gardener, a weed. And under the picture, and that was a nice weed. It was like a dandelion or something. Under the picture of the dandelion, there was a quote from Suzuki Roshi, and it said, "A weed is a treasure. A weed is a treasure." And, you know, this was completely right, you know. As a gardener, of course, the weeds are your nemesis. You know, you're always... And my gardening business was... I wasn't a very sophisticated gardener. So mainly my gardening business consisted of getting rid of the weeds rather than, like, you know, designing somebody's beautiful garden or anything like that. I really didn't know how to do that, but I knew how to hoe and I knew how to pull weeds. So, you know, it was that kind of a gardening business, just trying to keep the weeds down. So, but, you know, the weeds literally were my treasure, because without the weeds, I wouldn't have had, you know, I was literally turning weeds into treasure, into my livelihood. So it was a very relevant kind of a gesture on her part to give me that card. So I said something here about facing the weeds of consciousness is what we do on our cushions, though it shouldn't be called doing. Sit down and the weeds of consciousness will be obvious. These weeds don't need pulling, but we also don't just let them grow. Just let the weeds of consciousness come and go. The weeds of consciousness are not really yours, but still you take full responsibility for them. When we are patient with the weeds of consciousness, our patience turns them into treasures. Our patience with the weeds of consciousness turns consciousness into a treasure. But it's not really doing anything. It's mostly just our capacity for patience and letting patience do its work. And, you know, patience will do its work. But we have to be patient. So there's this other story along the same lines from the record of Dungshan. And this is maybe, I have to confess, one of my all-time favorite Zen stories. and maybe you've heard it before. But in this one, it's Yunyan is the teacher and Dungshan the student. And Dungshan, of course, will become the great master, but at this time in the story, he's still a student. And so he goes to his teacher and he says, "I have some habits that are not yet eradicated. I have some habits that are not yet eradicated." And Yunyan asks him, "What are you doing? What have you been doing?" And Dungshan replies, "I have not concerned myself with the Four Noble Truths." What? "I have not concerned myself with the most basic teachings of Buddhism," in other words. And Yunyan is nonplussed by this answer. And he says, "Are you joyful yet?" And Dungshan replies, "It would be untrue to say that I am not joyful. It is though I have grasped a bright pearl in a pile of dung." It is though I have grasped a bright pearl in a pile of dung. The story begins with a confession, which is a good way, if you're meeting with your teacher, a good way to start your dialogue, a time-honored way of starting your dialogue with your teacher is to make confession. So this starts with a confession. "I have some habits that have not yet been eradicated." Another translation is, "I have some karma, the results of some actions that are presumably unwholesome karma. I have some unwholesome karma that has not yet been eradicated." So that's another translation. In other words, I'm not perfect. I'm practicing with this personality. I have fears. I have worries. I sometimes get bored. I sometimes get upset. Sometimes I don't even want to pay attention. I don't even want to be present. So these are the kinds of things that you might be aware of. And, you know, personally, I would say that even after 40 years of practicing Zen, I guess this isn't a good advertisement for practicing Zen, but I haven't noticed that I don't you know, I haven't noticed that all my unwholesome karma has been eradicated. Which is sad. But I would also say, I wouldn't say that I'm not joyful. I would also say that I wouldn't say that I'm not joyful. So, you know, there's a great saying I heard from Reb, and then I saw it in one of the Reb Anderson is a Zen teacher I was hanging out with earlier this year, and he said this phrase, and I ran across it in a koan. It says, the horse arrives before the donkey leaves the barn. You heard that one? You heard him say that? Yeah, from Rev. The horse arrives before the donkey leaves the barn. So this is encouraging words for us. You know, it's not like we have to become perfect first, and then we can practice. Then we can wake up. You know, our habits that have not yet been eradicated can come along for the ride. They can come along with us on our journey of practice. And hopefully they will be informed by our journey of practice. They will be, they will learn something from that journey, and they will be, you know, calmed and so forth. And that would, and I can certainly say that, yes, in 40 years of practice, of course, I got 40 years older too, so who knows, but I would say that 40 years of practice has had some, you know, that kind of teaching has come through to my bad habits. But I just want to say something about the basic practice that we do here, and I feel like I should really bring this up every time I'm given an opportunity to talk. You know, the basic practice that we do here in Japanese is called, we have two words for it. One is zazen, which just means sitting meditation. But the other one, which is a little bit more descriptive, is called shikantaza. And literally it means just hit sit. And usually what we say is just sitting. We say just sitting. And this is a more descriptive and an apt word for what we are doing here on the cushion part of our practice. You know, we have various parts of our practice. The cushion part, we have a study part, we have blah blah part. You know, the heart of Zen practice is this cushion part. And what we're doing on the cushion is best described as shikantaza, and the best way I can think of to describe shikantaza is sitting. It's hard. It's sitting that just lets sitting sit. So I know that's kind of probably not too helpful. Let me see if I see if what I wrote here is any better. I said, the occasion when sitting is just sitting, sitting. The occasion, you know, Dogen likes to use that word, the occasion. He often says, on this occasion or in such and such occasion. He uses that word quite a lot often. So there's an occasion when sitting is just sitting, sitting. There is such an occasion, and this is an occasion that is beyond the barrier of thought. So this is an occasion that's beyond the barrier of thought. So there is going beyond the barrier of thought. On occasion. There is an occasion for it. And we should, well, should's not a good word, but we might want to appreciate that occasion. And we might want to dedicate ourselves to that occasion. We might want to, I was going to say worship, but that's a word that's going to get people nervous. Anyway, we might want to do these things. We might generate that kind of feeling about sitting that's just sitting, sitting. Or you could even say sitting that's free of sitting. So this kind of dedication, this kind of concentration, this kind of effort, this kind of that kind of movement is the movement called Zen. The movement called Zen is a movement of the occasion when sitting is just sitting, sitting, and at that time, just this person is A-OK. This person who's doing the sitting is just fine, and that person has some habits that haven't yet been eradicated. There's still a donkey around. There's still a donkey around, but that's okay. Because at that time, you trust that the horse has arrived, even though the donkey is still around. And, you know, this is what encourages us. This is what encourages us to keep coming back for more of the same. So I was going to end by saying that if someone were to ask me, after you, Reverend So-on, you, Jim Hare, when you leave this place, what would you like? What would you like us to say about you? What would you want us to say about you? And I would say, well, if someone asked that question, I would want them to say, you know, he had a lot of problems. He really wasn't, sometimes he didn't appear to be completely, a person of great enlightenment. You know, I could still see that he had some issues, in other words. I could still see that he had some stuff he was working with, and he would get upset occasionally. But you know what? One thing I really thought, I really thought that Reverend So-on, I thought he had an authentic encounter with the Buddha way. And that's what I remember him for. That's what I remember about Reverend So-on. I think he was really persistent. He sat every day, and I think he really had an authentic encounter with the Buddha way. And I bring that up not so that this is what you'll say about me, you know, in the future. But what one thing is really important is that in Sangha, we see, you know, that we have some people around with some persistent habits, some habits that have not yet been eradicated, right? We see every person we meet, we think that person has a habit that has not been eradicated of such and such kind. And every time I meet them, I see that habit. But the difference in Sangha is that we appreciate that there are these people also we trust, and we see that they're having an authentic engagement from time to time, at least, that there's authenticity there, there's sincerity there, and we see our Sangha members' sincerity. And when we see the sincerity of people on the way, then we can be much more tolerant of their habits that have not yet been eradicated. And we see that kind of dedication that they have, even though they're still, you know, caught in comparative mind and various other bad habits, various other mistaken ways of relating to self and others. But we see their authenticity, we see their sincerity, we see that they come back week after week, they do practice at home, they do retreats, they do various things that show us there's a sincere effort there. So that's all I really wanted to say tonight. And if you have one or two questions, we could have one or two questions. It's gotten clear to the end of the time pretty much, but we could have a couple of minutes.
The question I had a comment, but I'll leave that off since we're so close to the end. The question I had to do with the portion of your talk that you did not intend to give, that of transmission. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that every one of these transmission stories that I've read, the student or teacher says something. There is a seemingly nonsensical reply, and then so-and-so became enlightened. But they never actually say what that was.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened there?
Well, they didn't say, so how am I supposed to know? Myo has brought this up more than once, that they never actually say, well, what did that look like? You know, what did he... You know, I don't know if you've seen this movie about Dogen. I mean, there's a movie they made about Dogen. And actually, at the moment of enlightenment, he ascends. He ascends into heaven in the movie. He goes whirling up into heaven. So, you know, people have various ideas about about enlightenment. But in the stories, in the old stories, they don't say what he then manifested.
Occasionally, one of the stories. Occasionally, I seem to recall the stories will say the student was greatly enlightened and bowed to the teacher, And the teacher seeing this, now that you've seen this, what have you to say, or what have you seen that causes you to bow so this way? But I don't think it helps that much. The student says intimacy or bows again or something like that.
Yeah.
But I like those stories. I like it when there's that follow-up.
Yeah, it's important to note that not every Zen story ends that way, too. Not every Zen story ends with, the final. And it's kind of funny in our tradition to always have words be the occasion for enlightenment. It seems odd in our tradition to have words be the occasion for insight. Maybe it could, and I don't know how you would portray a moment of enlightenment without words. So maybe that's why words are always there at that time, because otherwise we couldn't know about them. But let's probably say that there are many unrecorded instances of awakening. And let's say also that many of these occurred in silence. I think that must be true.
Or a hosu, a banner, a fist, or a shout.
Yeah, exactly. Hosu, a banner, a fist, or a shout. That's from a Bukan Zazengi text that we chant here sometimes. Okay, thank you very much.